From Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training centers in Denver, Colorado, and Anchorage, Alaska, this is Dog Works Radio, committed to families and their dogs to build lifelong and fulfilling relationships. Visit our website at dogworksradio.com. Dog Works Radio is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Now, here are your hosts, Robert and Michelle Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. It is Robert Forto hosting from Willow, Alaska, the mushing capital of the world. It is a balmy minus 26 degrees up here in Willow, and it is wintertime. Michelle, how are you?
I'm freezing.
That's okay. We're in the midst of a great snowfall year. The trails are awesome here for dog sledding, and I'm looking so forward to talking to our guest today. His name is Joe Henderson. He is the author of a brand new book called Malamute Man. And before we get into that, we are going to talk about dog sledding today on Dog Works Radio. And you know what? They canceled the Copper Basin today, the Copper Basin 300 race, because of extreme trail conditions and weather. That is almost unprecedented for a major race like the Copper Basin to be canceled just a few hours ago.
You know, I haven't been here full-time that long yet. This is my first winter. This is your second winter. And I'm really feeling like I brought the snows with me from Colorado. They're not getting as much this year as they were usually getting. And it is unheard of that the CB 300 would be canceled because of trail conditions. But, you know, the first and foremost thing is the safety of those teams, dogs and mushers alike, as well as the volunteers that help along the trail. From what I understand, we have had an extreme amount of snow, which is typical Alaska for the old-timers that have been here. They like this kind of snow. I do, too. But I've also learned that you don't pray for sunshine here after a snowstorm. You pray for the clouds so that it stays a little warmer.
Well, you know, I know our good friend Hugh Neff is taking part in the Copper Basin this week, and I'm sure he will have stories to tell on the Gypsy Musher later this week, and we can get really a hands-on view of what happened on the race. But like you said, we are worried about the safety and concern of the dogs and the mushers, and of course, all of the volunteers, because many of those volunteers, they've never been out in weather like this.
Well, or they haven't been out in weather like this for extreme periods of time. You know, we're at negative 27, negative 30 here early on this morning, and I know where the Copper Basin is. They were slated to be in the negative 50 range just because of the wind chill factor. We are socked in with a high-pressure system because you like to call me Dusty Storm. I'm going to go ahead and give the little weather report. The weather is dangerous up here, and you have to be wary of it. You have to be prepared. Hypothermia sets in very quickly, and, you know, already this year they found a person that had gone missing just for a little while, and he had died half naked in the creek because he suffered from hypothermia. It causes you to think that you're warm, and you'll take off your clothes and die right there.
Well, you know, our guest today, he is no stranger to extreme weather. He is the Malamute Man. He spends months upon months of his life out on the trails in northern Alaska and the Arctic region. And I look so forward to talking to him about his new book and some of his adventures. So let's bring him up right now, calling in from, I assume, Fairbanks area, Joe Henderson. Joe, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Great to be with you today. How are you guys doing?
We're doing very well, thank you. So where are you calling in from?
Fairbanks.
Fairbanks.
Blue Rivers area.
What is the weather like up there?
It's not too bad. It's clear skies and 44 below. 44.
You know, 44 below, when people hear that in the lower 48, they think, oh, my goodness, how do people survive in that kind of weather? Can you give us a little bit of experience about that? Like Michelle said, we've only been up here a couple of years, and I'm kind of used to it, but Michelle's sitting here in the studio wrapped up in a blanket, and it's only minus 26. How do people live in minus... How do people live a daily life in minus 44 below, like in Fairbanks?
It doesn't change things. As far as in Fairbanks, the vehicles are a pain. You know, they're always breaking down and freezing up and whatnot. But it's all relative. I mean, 44 below is fine with me because I'm used to, you know, a little bit more extreme temperatures. So So I suppose if I was from the Arizona desert, 44 below would probably kill me. I think it's all relative.
So when you're out and about at those types of temperatures up in Fairbanks, you said that the vehicles break down all the time. And I know we have a lot of listeners from groups that you're involved in, Malamute groups and whatnot, that don't know a whole lot about Alaska. And you say it's relative, but how do people, you know, how do they adjust to that sort of stuff, you know, from a summer of 60 or 70 down almost 100 to 115 degrees below that to minus 44? What type of changes do you have to make in your daily life to go from that extreme in the summer to that extreme in the winter?
Yeah, there's a lot of things you have to do to, you know, winterize your vehicles. You know, you have to use plug-ins. You have to keep it plugged in. Maybe go to a lighter oils. Your differentials have problems, you know, the axles. Most people have garages they park their vehicles in. It helps all, but as far as the houses, of course, we all use heat tape and to keep our pipes warm and to keep the water from freezing. As far as cells, we just pull out the Arctic gear and live every day as we normally do.
And can you talk to our listeners just a little bit about the sunlight and you know, the darkness of winter? I know a lot of people ask us about that. How is it up in Fairbanks? What are you guys dealing with in terms of daylight hours? And how do you guys up there survive in that darkness like that? You know, I know that's difficult for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of people bring that up. Our daylight right now is maybe, I'm not sure, maybe 9 to 4, let's say. And the sun comes up probably 3 or 4 hours. I'm not sure. I haven't timed it. I don't notice it. A lot of people just can't stand it being in the dark like this. It's kind of a dusk most of the time. In the Arctic, the sun hasn't even risen yet. The sun is down for 72 days in the Arctic. So it's kind of like a dawn all the time, just a gray light. The brightest time of the day, you still have to use a headlight, you know, for your headlamp. But I don't, it doesn't bother me. Of course, I'm used to it, and I think it just takes time to get used to.
Right, and I'm looking forward to talking about some of those Arctic adventures that you take part in every year. And you've written a book about it called Malamute Man. Can you tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll go into a couple of stories here and there.
Okay, the book is a memoir that showcases bits and pieces of my life and how I got working with Alaskan Malamutes and how I came to the Arctic and started doing my dog sledding expeditions. And it's a glimpse of just a lot of different ways, stories I've survived up there. It kind of starts open up a picture of what the Arctic is truly like.
It is a new book, right, Joe?
That's correct, yeah. It's just on the market just a few days ago on Amazon. And I have plenty of good pictures in it, and hopefully be following up with a couple more books as soon as I get a chance to sit down long enough to write them.
Joe, is it available on ebook format as well, or is it just in paper format?
Right now, it's just paperback.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, I hear you. I like the traditional style myself still. Robert's into the ebooks, but I haven't converted completely yet. I like the way the book smells, the way it feels. It just feels like you really get into it that way. So what prompted you to write these memoirs, Joe?
Well, my dad. My dad passed away last year, and that was one of the things he wanted me to do, was to start writing about my adventures, and so I'm going to start, and hopefully when I retire in 40 years, I'll have a collection of them.
Well, no better way to tell your story than through writing. I know these days so much of our history, especially in the North, is still concentrated on oral history, but the more books that are published about dog sledding, adventures with dogs, the better, at least in my opinion. Of course, that is our passion here on our show, as well as in our daily lives. Not only are we mushers, but we're dog trainers and dog owners and everything like that. So let's talk first, before we get into some of the adventures, about your dogs. It's interesting, when I found out about you on Facebook, somebody just posted a link and I wanted to contact you right away, and hopefully we're one of the first interviews to you about your book. Let's talk about the Malamutes. That's a breed that I have loved for years. I'm a Siberian Husky guy myself, but I know my little Siberians probably couldn't do what your dogs do. Let's talk about the Malamute. What in the world makes those guys so special?
They are the most special breed I've ever worked with. I've worked with many, many different breeds of dogs my entire life, from beagles to hound dogs. I mean, all types of dogs, different husky types. And Malamutes are just really an intelligent dog. They're tough, and when they fall in love with you, you can really see it in their eyes. Their whole driving force, their whole makeup, what drives them is their love, and they want to please you, and it really makes them strong dog, and they will do anything for you, and so it creates a bond with you and the dog, and it's kind of a mutual thing. You would do anything for the dog, and they would do anything for you, and when you live, you know, months on end out in the wilderness with no other humans, it's kind of nice to have, 20 of your best friends around you all the time, although they don't ever speak to me, but... not in the human form, but they sure howl a lot. So they're a special dog, and they're tough. And they can, about the only dog that I know of in Alaska, as far as breeds go, that can endure, unblow wind chills without a problem. I've been out feeding my dogs in blizzards, and they're out playing and around and playing with each other. And it's, the wind is blasting 40, 50 mile an hour with 90 blow wind chill, and they're just right at home.
How many do you have, Joe?
I have about 35 right now.
And when you're out on your expeditions up in the Arctic, again, I apologize, I don't know a whole lot about your expeditions other than what I've read on the internet. Are you using kind of the old school sledge and the fan hitch and that sort of stuff? Tell us about how you set up your teams for these adventures.
Okay, the hitch I kind of modified or devised myself. The key is to get the most power, you can out of a team. And I find by using eight-wheel dogs, when I'm on the seacoast, I can use eight-wheel dogs, and I'll have rows of three and four and five abreast ahead of the wheel dogs. And that really, really is a strong way to have your team hooked up. And in the mountains, I use three abreast because the snow is really deep. Snow is sometimes 3 to 5 feet deep, and it just makes it better for breaking trail. I use 22 dogs. It seems like the magic number with me because it's not too large of a team and it's not too small. And there's really nothing that can stop us. If I place my a mark on the map, I can make it there, and I'm not worried about being, the snow might be too deep, we can't break through it. We will break through it, and we'll get there eventually, even if it takes several seasons to finally get there. I kind of, and then my sleds, they're big, they're made for and designed to go on deep snow. They're about 3 feet wide, 10 or 12 feet long. I attach three of them together when I start out with about 1,000 or 1,200 pounds in each sled. And 3,500 pounds is usually what I start out with, and they're last 3 months' supplies. And over the mountain passes, I have to, unload, maybe drop a sled and relay the sleds up over the mountain pass. And that's how I travel all winter.
That's very interesting. Of course, me being involved in racing and just regular old mushing for all these years, I love to hear about the old school mushers that are still using that old school stuff, all those dogs and those big sleds and things. And, a lot of people haven't ever witnessed that or been a part of that. How is it different if you've been involved in just a regular dog team, the tandem hitch with the leader and the wheel dogs and the team dogs and that? Have you ever been on a sled just set up in a normal race type fashion compared to how you do it?
Oh yeah. I used to have a little racing team. I used to run for fun. It's completely different. It's a whole different ballgame. There's not even you couldn't even compare it. The training is different. You have to have, specific commands. especially a stop and go command, that is, you know, without the L2 commands, you wouldn't be able to do it. And because you're not going to be able to stop a team of mailmates by putting a brake on. And so most of my traveling is in front of the team, snowshoeing or skiing. Although when I'm on the Arctic coast, I'll get on the runners of the sled or sit on the sled and allow the leaders to go. And that's another thing is you have to train the leaders to navigate when there's zero visibility. And they navigate through wind direction. They detect which wind direction you're going, and they keep that course. Or they actually, a lot of them will follow the snow drifts. The snow drifts blow, will line themselves east and west, and whatever angle you've started out on the day, a good lead dog will watch those drifts and stay at that same angle. It's like a compass between the drifts and wind. So it's a whole different story. There's really no comparison. The dogs don't wear booties or jackets, and we don't use straw. It's just really uncomparable, really.
So let's talk about the Arctic itself. I've never been up that far north, at least not yet, but it is an entirely different world up there. Literally, it's just a blank slate, right? There's pretty much nothing there except a barren landscape, right?
No. Well, I mean, on the coast, yes. Yeah. But, you have the sea ice and the jumbled ice and the ridges, and even that can be pretty in a lot of days. You have the polar bears on the coast and stuff. But in the mountains, it's just dramatic country. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's jagged. It's rugged. You have lots of obstacles to deal with every day. You have canyons and crevasses and steep cliffs and mountain passes. And the wildlife is awesome. You usually have a lot of doll sheep and wolves. It's phenomenal country. It's something like out of this you don't ever see very often. And that's all part of the Arctic. And probably not many see that part of the Arctic in the winter since it's so inaccessible. Unless you use a dog team of some type. But.
And your website is AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com, is that correct?
That's correct.
And you can find out more about that on our website at dogworksradio.com. We do have a link up there, AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com. So, Joe, when you're out for months on end, what is the purpose of that? Are you doing some type of research? Or are you just out there getting from point A to point B? What is the purpose of going out for all this time?
Just to satisfy my passion. I just love the exploring. I love the wilderness. I love the Arctic, and I love the Malamutes. And, of course, I do have goals in mind. Land is fascinating, and I find a really interesting place on a map that I'd like to go to with the dog team. And sometimes it takes several seasons. I'll get maybe half of the way there, one season in a three-month time, and the following winter I'll work further and further towards that goal, and finally sometimes, I'll reach it within three seasons. It's a challenge. That is a challenge, and also the time that's spent with the Malamutes is priceless, and as well as being in the mountains and in such an, extreme. Of course, it's not all roses and daisies. I mean, we get beat up quite a bit by blizzards and hard times and stuff like that. But, just being out, they say when you're in the mountains, you're closer to God. And sometimes I feel right on his doorstep because it's just pristine country. And I have gone all 5 months at a time without seeing another single person out there. So it's really great country.
And you said you're carrying well over 1,000 pounds of gear with you on your sled with your dogs. Can you describe for us a typical day out there on one of your expeditions? Kind of give us the idea from the time you wake up to the time you go to bed. What's involved with that? Can you talk a little bit about the feeding regimen and what's going on during that period of time you're out on the trail?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, first thing I do in the morning is feed dogs. Boil a pot of coffee and eat a big moose steak or caribou steak, and and then hitch up the team. I use 22 dogs and load the sleds. It takes 2 or 3 hours to break camp, and I usually take off on the snowshoes for a little ways, and the dogs will wait for me to get ahead, and I'll give them the word to go, and then they're take off and eventually catch up to me, and we're continuing through the day. Like I said, there's a lot of obstacles. It's not just a white plane of easy traveling. But sometimes, you know, there's been days where, you know, when the snow is 4 or 5 feet deep, we're going to only average a mile an hour because it's pretty tough. And there's been a few days when I've, at the end of traveling eight hours, I looked back through the binoculars. I saw my old campsites, you know, 5 miles away. So, and I like to travel 8 hours and then camp, set up the tent, and feed dogs. The dogs get fed twice a day, and they get picketed out. And they stay really fresh. I think using such a large team is the reason why we can keep traveling every day for 100 days, consecutive 100 days. And the dogs, they adjust to the routine, and every day is a challenge for both me and the dogs, since we get to see some really interesting country. And in the sled, we start out with, we go through about 1,000 pounds of dog food a month. So on a four-month trip, I'll have 4,000 pounds and plus my food and my gear. And a three-month trip is usually the sleds are loaded with 3,500 pounds of stuff.
So, Joe, you know, a lot of people down in the lower 48 are not going to be able to even comprehend, let alone the amount of weight that you're asking the dogs to pull, but the fact that, you know, the dogs are out there living with you day in and day out for that long of a period of time. You know, down there in the lower 48, people have a different idea of what a working dog is and what a working dog is supposed to do. You are doing exactly what those dogs were meant to do. You know, they're meant to be out there with a man and helping him along the way. That's why we have Malamutes. But I want you to kind of help us understand, you know, you said no booties and no coats, and I'm over here laughing because I know all these people, even over here where I live, are putting coats and booties on their dogs when it's just zero. So I praise you for understanding your animals enough to know that that's not what they need. They need a good, hearty meal, and they need to be out there living on the land like you do.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, dogs acclimate just like people. I suppose if you raised a Malamute in the Arizona desert, he'd come up here and probably get pretty chilly. But they acclimate, and they love it. I mean, the dogs love it. In fact, this year I have one little guy that he's an old leader, and he won't contribute much to the team because he's relatively old, but I have to take him because I know it would break his heart if he saw me pull out of the yard with the trailer and dogs and him not going. It's what these guys love to do. That's what they're born to do. It's their environment. It's believed that they even originated, you know, on the North Slope of Alaska or in the Arctic. And as far as hardiness, their tails are waving high every day. That's my gauge. As long as the tails are up and waving, those guys are happy. When they're happy, they're always howling. And even when we stop for a break, they sit on their haunches and howl. It's their environment, and they acclimate just like I do. And it's just an interesting thing that that people are wondering, you know, about the dogs, I guess, health up there. But they're happy. And my goal is to, when I come back, I always have a goal to have them heavier than what they leave as far as weight. We don't ration like you would think. So.
And you said you had about 3,000 pounds of dog food for a three-month adventure. What are you feeding your guys exactly out on the trail?
I'm using National Competition Extra Formula dry kibble, and I mix that with oil. And they do very well on that, twice a day.
And are you feeding any type of meat supplements with that, any fish, anything like that?
No, I'm not. They, like I said, they gain weight, and just on that alone, and it's a lot of genetics. Malamutes have a really efficient digestive system, anyhow, and my particular line, that's one of my breeding programs. You know, I like to breed the dogs that do have good digestive systems, good metabolism, that can maintain a good layer of fat on them while we're out.
And we're talking to Joe Henderson, the author of Malamute Man. His website is AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com, AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com. And we're talking about his brand-new book, Malamute Man, and his adventures on his expedition, sometimes 3, 4, or 5 months out on the trails of northern Alaska and the Arctic without seeing a soul. And I'm here with our co-host, Michelle Forto, as well. Michelle, do you have another question for Joe?
Joe, have you ever taken anyone else out with you for the experience? Would there be a way for someone to, you know, tag along, even if it wasn't for the extended period of time?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, this year I don't do it every year, but this year I have a gentleman that would join me for 10 days and another gentleman that would join me for 5 weeks. This is... the gentleman that's going for 5 weeks, this is his fourth trip with me, so he's well rehearsed on the routine. But it's a good trip. They snowshoe or ski in ahead of the team or behind the team. No one rides on the sleds. The dogs have enough to carry.
And, absolutely.
And you can look under that on our website. There's some information on that. If someone wants to join the trip someday.
So, Joe, back in the day, this was the primary mode of transportation of the North, as well, not only in Alaska and Canada, but also Greenland and areas throughout the North. Do you see a lot of other folks doing this now, or is it pretty much all snow machines and different ways of transportation compared to back in the day?
Yeah, the snow machines have pretty much taken over. I've never seen another dog team up there where I go. In April, a lot of folks from Fairbanks go up there and run their teams around in the mountains there. But in the hills and the deep mountains, yeah, there's no one traveling. I've talked to a lot of elders in the villages, in Inupiat villages, and they all used to travel the area back in the day, you know, early 1900. And around 1940, 1950, I think, is when the snow machines one that was introduced, and the dogs kind of disappeared.
Do you think that they disappeared because of the snow machine or the cost of taking care of the dogs as we changed from a different type of society, like you said, back in the 50s and 60s?
Oh, it's probably both. The interest, they lost interest. I mean, they could go with snow machine. They didn't have to deal with the dog in the summertime. Didn't have to worry about feeding them, so it's more convenient for them, and you kind of can't blame them. I don't know. I'm in love with the dogs, so I continue doing what I do, I guess.
So when you're out up there in this part of the country, do you ever see any of these small villages or encampments, possibly hunting camps or anything like that, where people are still sustaining their livelihood up there? Or is it pretty much just you and your dog team and nobody else?
Pretty much me and my dog team. Now, as you get closer to the Kaktovik, in April, there'll be some fish camps along the rivers. You know, as the rivers start opening up, people will start catching fish. They'll be camped out, but there's no dog teams. It's all snow machines.
You know, that's an interesting point of view to share with our listeners. So many people that listen to our show, they think that they have wide open space if they have an acre or two yard. And then we're talking about you don't see anybody for 5 months. I think that's a real eye-opener for people that listen to our show in their living rooms or driving in their car in rush hour, how much different life is up in the North compared to the big city, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. It really gives you perspective. I mean, if you were to walk for 5 months across the country, you would be seeing people every, you know, few minutes. And it's just you really put it in good perspective there. You travel someplace for 5 months without ever even seeing another person or even a sign of a person is it gives you an idea of the expanse of Alaska's Arctic and its Arctic wilderness.
So 5 months is a heck of a long time. Has anything ever happened where you've needed to evacuate, whether it be personal injury or some type of family emergency or something, where you just had to get up and go, you know, drop everything and get out of there?
No, thank God. I've been very, very blessed that no such things ever happened. I mean, I've been in many, many life-threatening situations and stuff, but you know, I've always been able to get out of it and survive. And I've never had to. There was a lot of times I probably should have been evacuated, but I didn't have the means to even contact anyone during those days. I didn't have satellite phones or anything like that. So I'm just basically have to put my trust in God that I survive one day to the next, and dogs say they do their part, and it's kind of like a code. You know, I rely on the dogs, and they depend on me, and we're a team. And a lot of the photos I did put on the internet and Facebook are me pulling with the team. I mean, this might, you know, it sounds absurd that I could even help with the team pulling, but it gives them encouragement. And so I think by being together all the time and working together, that any dangerous situation is less of a chance, because we're just breaking the trail together, and I'm not going to fall off in a crevasse someplace. You know, they're going to detect thin ice, stuff like that.
So do you have a way to contact authorities or other people? Do you use satellite phones these days? I know even in the Iditarod and Serum Run and that sort of stuff, they're relying more and more on the GPS trackers and emergency beacons. Do you guys carry anything like that?
Yeah, now I carry a satellite phone, and I check in with my wife every day. So if she doesn't hear from me, she would probably get worrying and maybe send someone out there, but it's not exactly a type of country where you can just go out and pick someone up. You'd have to have a helicopter and GPS coordinates, and the weather would have to be just right for the helicopter to fly. And a lot of times, I get it so out of range from the civilization, I guess. It's hard to say if the helicopter could make it there without refueling somehow. So there's always that thing there. So, but yes, I do carry an Iridium satellite phone now.
And those things aren't cheap, are they? I know that it's not like your typical cell phone where you can just chat away. It's a pretty expensive endeavor to call somebody on a satellite phone.
Yes, it's really expensive. The whole Arctic exploring is super expensive, but I work all summer just so I can go every winter.
Can you share a little bit with us about that, if you don't mind? How much does an expedition like this cost per year?
Oh, boy, yeah. I mean, you have to have everything shipped up along the Dalton Highway, which is pretty high freight cost. The logistics of getting your dogs up there, and you have to have a place to put your vehicle. That myself, I rent a vehicle. And then I have someone drive it back to Fairbanks with me. And once I get dropped off, that's it. I won't have any vehicle there. Because what happens is the vehicle gets buried in snow, and it can damage it pretty good. And it takes a large team. I have several people that help me get up there. Quite a few people help me get back. And when you combine all those expenses and the premium dog food and the gear and the clothing and everything, it mounts up every year.
So the Dalton Highway, that's the Ice Road Truckers fame, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the infamous Dalton Highway.
The infamous now. Everybody knows where the Dalton Highway is if they've watched Ice Road Truckers. So that's the area where you begin. And then I assume you head due west from there?
Yeah, east or west. I like to go east, but some years I go west. It just depends on where I choose to travel. Like I said, I do a lot of history research, and I like to see where the old explorers had gone, or if they have gone these places, and try to follow their steps. I followed did a Leffingwell expedition from Ernest de Koven. Leffingwell, he explored up there in 1907 to 1914, and I got some of his old maps and his journals and followed his route. And that took 3 years to cover his ground. He covered a lot of ground, and I still didn't get it all. But it just makes all part of a good story someday.
Joe, have you ever been commissioned by the government to do any further exploring from where the old guys left off? I mean, I know some of them back then in the 1800s and 1900s were actually asked to do the exploring by you know, the government and the president's office and things. Have you ever been asked to take up where someone left off?
No, I haven't. In fact, many of the places I travel, there hasn't been a dog team ever traveled there and recorded history. So it would be great if they did ask me, but
well, maybe I just helped you out there, because I mean, you're up there doing what you love for yourself, but I mean, you're also up there and you're writing these memoirs like your father asked you to do, which I think was probably the best idea out there, because you're able to record for us what's going on up there. You know, I mean, you said you saw wolf sightings and you see doll sheep, and I'm sure you see other types of animals. It would be great to know just how many are up there, you know, because we can't always trust what someone down in the lower 48 says is happening up here in our neck of the woods.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I hear some many things from lower 48 or actually biologists. When I see, you know, I just know that's just not right, especially when it comes to wildlife. I see a lot of strange-looking wild, you know, that shouldn't be up there, like mink or marten and stuff like that. It shouldn't be on the Arctic coast, but once in a while,
well,
you see it.
You know, as long as you haven't seen an abominable snowman, I'm sure we're safe.
Yeah.
Joe, I'm looking at your website now, AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com, and on the front page, the home page in your banner, it's an excellent picture of you and your dog team.
My God,
and
they look so happy.
They do, and it describes that hitch that you talked about at the beginning of the show, how they're spread out across a pretty good distance there in the back. You said you were using 8-wheel dogs at a time?
Yeah, on the Arctic coast, I'll use 8-wheel dogs, and they have a roll of 5 and 4. Then I think the leaders, I'll have maybe 3 or 4 leaders also. Depends on, you know, who's feeling good that day. Working with Malamutes is like working with a bunch of kids, you know. So someday they get along with the running mate, someday they don't. But, yeah, that's my coastal hitch. Then in my mountain hitch, I use 3 abreast.
And also on the homepage there, there's a picture of you walking in front of the team on a set of snowshoes. And when a lot of mushers think about that, there's no way in the world most of us could walk in front of our teams and we get run over. Is that just due to the extreme weight of the sleds, or is that because that's where the dogs know they need to be?
It's just that's where the dogs know they need to be. It's training. I know what you mean. If you get run over by your team, it's pretty, especially a racing team. But, yeah, they're trained. And if we're on really good ground and I'm skied and they're just keeping up with me really well and they might step on the back of my ski or something, I'll just tell them to stay. I'll tell them to stop and stay. Then I'll ski ahead until I can, you know, barely see them. Then I'll yell back and tell them to come. And then they're finally catch up to me in a half hour, 45 minutes. We do the same routine.
You know, I think this is so cool. I'm a big dog sledding history buff. I've written a lot about some of the old timers, you know, the Serum Run guys and the guys that, you know, that made this sport popular, I guess, at least from a sport perspective. But I admire you from going out there and living life like they used to. And what a way to live, Joe. To go out several months at a time and to do this and do what you love. My next question to you is a question that I'm sure we're going to get from our listeners at some point, especially if they're looking on your website. It looks like you're pretty balmy right there, especially on your homepage. Your coat's unzipped and you look like you're out for a Sunday drive. What are some of the temperature extremes that you see in the summertime? I know it's much warmer than it is in the winter, but what are you dealing with on a daily basis?
In the winter?
No, in the summer.
Oh, in the summer. In here in Fairbanks, it can get pretty hot. in the Arctic and get pretty warm too. I used to live up there also, and it used to get in the 70s and 80s. In the winter, the the extremes can be 100 below wind chill to 30 or 40 above in any month of the year. I do get acclimated to the cold quite a bit. I mean, I used to have outside temperature in my tent, and at 45 degrees, I'd start getting too hot. So it's just a kind of acclimation thing. And at 20 below, I mean, I'm comfortable with a coat unzipped and running around that way.
And you're doing most of these expeditions in the summer months, right?
Oh, no. Oh, no. I start in January.
Oh, you start. I apologize. You did say you're leaving in a couple of weeks to start one of these expeditions. So you're back at the beginning of summer then.
Yeah. I'm leaving Friday. Actually, then I'll be back around May 10th. So I go up in the very worst part of the winter.
Wow. So you're out there in the true extremes, and I thought for some reason that you did this in the summertime, but I guess I didn't put all the dots together. So I
think you just couldn't fathom the fact that there was a man out there that wanted to go out between January and May and actually handle himself in the winter.
I think it's awesome. I would love to be able to do this. If I had the time and the money, I would want to live this same exact life, just being out there traveling with your dogs, exploring and doing what you want to do. What a way to live, and I admire you to that. Joe, your new book is called Malamute Man. It's available on Amazon as well as on your website, AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com. Can you share one story with us, maybe one of those crazy stories where you said you should have been evacuated or something that you just want to share with everybody? Maybe it's something in the book, maybe it's something that's not.
I have a million stories. But we do run into a lot of grizzly bears up there, and in the winter, which they shouldn't be out. They should be hibernating, but they're out. You know, a lot of times they get run out of their dens, and they, but one reason or another, and they're out hunting anything that moves. And once in a great while, we get one that would charge in on us, and. I think last year or year before, I had one. I was actually untangling the line of my lead dog, and my line stretched all out quite a ways. You're three sleds and you're all your dogs. So, and I keep my rifle in the very last sled, in the third sled. And I was untangling his line, and I heard a growl. And I looked behind my sled, and the grizzly bear was running full tilt toward us behind on our trail. And I knew that, you know, there's no way he's going to stop. And, you're not going to yell and scare this guy away. He's starving to death, and he's gonna eat some dogs. And that's what they're going for. And so my rifle was in the very last sled, and he was running towards my last sled, my third sled. And so it was a sprint for me to get to the sled, and he was sprinting towards me. So here, against all human nature... I was running as fast as I could towards this charging grizzly, and I knew I wouldn't make it in time. So I pulled out my knife as I was running, and I kind of planned on my attack where I would die on my sled, cut my gun case open with a knife, and hopefully draw up fast enough to stop him. And that's basically what I did. But I have hundreds of stories, and. I just have to. One of these days, I need to sit down and just write. I'm too busy chasing grizzly bears around.
You could be the next Discovery Channel show, don't you think?
Oh, I don't know. The dogs make. No, they deserve. The dogs deserve 100% of all.
Yeah, you don't want to have the trouble of hauling a camera crew around with you. That just put some head cams on those dogs. Tell your own story, Joe.
Yeah, there you go.
So when you sat down to finally write your book, Malamute Man, did you have a goal in mind? And again, I haven't had a chance to read it. Is it formatted in a certain way where it goes, is it one winter's adventure, or is it just kind of a spattering of stories that you recall and you wrote down?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like an introduction to me. I start with, you know, my childhood in Michigan with hunting dogs and then growing up and really getting explored, this explorer's bug, I think, and how I worked my way north to Alaska and logging camps and trap lines and finally ended up in the Arctic and doing what I'm doing. And then I have a lot of dog stories in it, and more of an introduction than my next books will be hopefully just a good dog sled, dog adventure stories and stuff like that.
So I want to just backtrack a little bit. Somebody on Facebook posted a question, and I guess they would like to hear the answer. Can you tell us about the different sizes of your dogs? Do you are all of your dogs relative the same size? Or can you tell us about the sex of your dogs, possibly the age, that sort of thing?
Sure, sure. That's the most common question, too. No, they're not all the same sizes. It'd be impossible for me to travel in the Arctic with all the same size dogs. The snow conditions vary so much. You have punchy snow, icy snow, deep snow, shallow snow. One dog doesn't fit all. You have to have the big dogs to plow through the deep powder. You have to have the small dogs that can get up on top of the punchy snow and lead the team. So, yes, our dogs have a huge range in size from 85 pounds to 130. After a certain size, 140 pounds is my limit. They're just specifically sea ice dogs, you know, for the coast because they have a tough time all around.
So, Joe, one of the other fans on Facebook is wondering, you know, without the booties and the coats, you know, we've discussed that earlier about how you've, you know, they're in their own element because that's where they're from. They're wondering how you keep their pads strong, even though they are experienced in the Arctic.
I have absolutely no problem with their feet. It's an interesting thing going on. They have a lot of fur on the bottom of their feet, and that fur is there for a reason. That's prevent their pads being worn down in the dry abrasive snow. The Arctic snows like sand in the winter. Of course, when it becomes March and April, it gets moisture again, and the sleds slide, and that's much easier, but they have big paws. Their feet are furry, and I'm sure it's a genetic thing that they just have leather on the bottom of their pads, and it doesn't bother them a bit.
Are you having to ship dogs back from wherever you're located? You mentioned some dogs are better on sea ice than others. Or do all the dogs start and stop with you in the expedition, or are you know, like in Iditarod and things where they drop dogs, or do they stay with you the entire time?
They stay with me the entire time. That's another beauty of having a large team like this. Not even though I have 22 dogs, not all 22 will be pulling every single day. Dogs have their moods, especially Malamutes. You know, they're just like a bunch of 12-year-old kids. So it's nice. I mean, if a dog just doesn't feel like pulling, it's no problem. He runs behind or sits on the sled or whatever. You see a lot of my photos of dogs sitting on sleds. It's just the way it is. You just take care of them. That's all I can say to that. I can't see flying anyone out. And if I do have one that's becoming sick or injured for some reason, we hang out for 3 or 4 days in the camp and wait for them to heal up.
That's a great lead into my next question. Have you ever been hunkered down for an extended period of time more than you thought was absolutely necessary? And do you have a story about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, every year we get pinned down by blizzards. Last year I got pinned down for 6 days solid. Just hurricane force winds. Non-ending for 6 solid days and nights, so you best have, you know, I make sure I have plenty of supplies with me, of course, and a lot of times when I relay my supplies over mountain passes, I'm really nervous because, you know, I might get pinned down on the wrong side of the mountain pass without my full load of supplies. The longest I've ever was pinned down was 13 days, and that was one of those times where I had to ration my groceries. Of course, the dogs, I can't eat dog kibble, so they did fine, but I think I lost a good 10 pounds.
you know, Joe, how do you entertain yourself for all that time, you know, hunkered down for 6 days at a time? I know you have to conserve fuel, and I'm sure batteries or whatever you're using for headlamps and that sort of stuff. What have you found that makes your life a little bit more enjoyable in the evenings and things when you finally are able to sit in the tent and relax a bit?
Yeah, one of the things about blizzards being pinned down, you're busy all day. A lot of times you have to stay up most of the night, digging out. You don't want to get yourself completely buried, and it's a tough time getting out. But, when I finally do settle down, the blizzard stops, and I got a few hours on my time there, I have books I read, and that's about the extent of it.
Anybody in particular? Are you a favorite of any author or anything like that?
I am. I love Ernest Hemingway. He's my favorite.
Taking after him yourself, an expeditioner and adventurer and that sort of stuff. So I got to admire a man that likes Hemingway. So the next question I have is, you've talked a little bit about the food that you feed the dogs. What do you eat on this multi-month adventure? What do you carry along with you? Do you have any special treat that you bring along that you save for particular points in the trip? Any things you want to share about that?
Sure. Yeah, one thing about taking treats along, you end up eating them all in one night. So I don't do that anymore. But I have what they call gluten intolerance or a celiac disease, so my diet is very limited anyhow. And I eat mostly meat, cheese, rice, and then once in a while I take along some frozen fruits and vegetables. But it's a really basic diet. But I do well on it. I guess my body's adjusted to it, and I take a lot of vitamins and vitamin C supplements. I drink a lot of coffee.
Is there anything you absolutely crave when you get back home to civilization that you just got to go out and have?
No.
You don't have to stop by the McDonald's or anything, and you got to grab a Big Mac. You're just ready to stop and move on to the next adventure, I guess.
Yeah. I start planning my, every spring I get kind of depressed because I know it's going to end soon. But that's all right. I pick myself up and start planning for the following winter.
So we have another question for you from Facebook. The lady is asking, what about temperamental issues? Do you have any of those on the trail where you're dealing with some feisty males or possibly females that are going into season or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like I said, they're a bunch of kids. I mean, you got 22 dogs and half of them are females, another half are males, and everyone is intact or everyone's going in season at once. At one time I had 9 females going in season all at once. So, but basically, they know you hook them up and they pull. I mean, they love to pull, and all that stuff is forgotten. It's just the way it is. I guess they're in such a great pattern that that stuff doesn't really bother them a whole lot.
So we're talking to Joe Henderson, the author of Malamute Man. His website is AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com. Joe, we have a few minutes left. Is there anything else you would like to share with our listeners? We have listeners from all over the world. They can download this show at any time on iTunes or through our website at dogworksradio.com. It's available forever. So you may get questions and comments 6 months from now after you get back from this expedition. But anything in particular you want to share to close the show?
Oh, it's, you can let another question in. I'm open to any questions. But, it's been an honor to be on your show.
Well, thank you, and I'm so glad we caught you before you left. Just next Friday, you're going to be gone for an extended period of time. My last question is, does anybody follow you? Do schools follow you at all, like, they do in the Iditarod? They follow mushers and whatnot. Do you have any programs like that where people can follow where you're at or what's going on with you and your dogs out there on the trails?
No, but, this year my wife and I talked about maybe posting every day, updates, every other day updates on probably your Facebook, or we have also a blog, Alaskan Arctic Expeditions .wordpress.com. I think you can get to it from our website. But we're talking about maybe posting every other day updates so people can follow.
Well, Joe, what I'd like to ask you is, would you be willing to come on the show in May when you get home and let us know how this trip went?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Maybe I'll have some good stories for you.
I'm sure you're going to have good stories for us. And what I'll do is I'll have Robert get in touch with you through an email, and we'll set it up where you've already got a show on schedule when you come home.
Well, sounds good. Thanks, Michelle.
You're welcome.
So, Joe, again, Malibu Man is the name of your book. You can buy it through your website, AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com, as well as on Amazon. What do you see happening with the book? What is your goal? Do you want to go on some type of book tour when you get back? What's the plan with the book when you get home?
Oh, it would be nice to have time to write another one. I guess I have to see how the book sells. I mean, it takes a lot of money to take time off. I have 35 dogs that have to eat, and a beautiful wife and daughter, and hopefully I can have time to write another book. But I sure enjoy writing now that I've started. I haven't been writing, my entire life, and my dad inspired me to write, so I sure enjoy it.
If you don't mind, Joe, let me ask you one more question. You talked about your wife and daughter. What do they think about husband and dad going out for half the year out on his own in the middle of nowhere? What is their response to it every year? Is it, go ahead and enjoy it, or, oh, my goodness, he's going again?
And my wife is very supportive. I mean, just fantastic. My daughter is 7 months old now. So
oh, wow.
She doesn't quite comprehend it yet, but I'm sure she'll be supportive just like her mom.
That's very cool. Michelle, any last question for Joe before we close?
You know, Joe, you've had your beautiful daughter. This year might be a little bit more difficult on you than you are expecting it to be, because once you have those kids, they get in your heart and soul just like those doggies. So you have a wonderful, safe trip, and I'm looking forward to talking with you in May.
All right. Thanks, Michelle.
Joe, it's been a pleasure. We'll definitely keep in touch, and we'll shoot any comments over your way. I know that I just joined a group today, World Malamutes or something. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, but I got an invitation to that group as well today, and that's where a lot of these questions are coming from. So you have a lot of fans out there and people really supporting you and what you do. So you got to admire that. People are really interested in what you do, because so many people don't understand this lifestyle, and that's what we try to showcase on this show, is a different type of life than what people are used to. So I'm glad that you're able to do that, and I'm glad you're able to maintain your passion. So it has been a pleasure. Let me give you one more plug before we close. Joe Henderson, the author of Malamute Man, AlaskanArcticExpeditions.com. We'll talk real soon, Joe, okay?
All right, thanks. Thanks a lot, and thanks for having me on the show, and thanks for everyone out there that supported me, and thanks for all your great comments on Facebook and our blog.
Thank you very much. Joe, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk again soon.
Okay, bye.
Michelle, anything you want to close with? Let's talk about this Alaskan winter to finish up. What in the world's going on this week here at Dogworks Radio?
I'll tell you what, I am enjoying learning as much as I can about Alaska and the Arctic, and a man like Joe tells a beautiful story, and I hope that all of his fans out there that listen to the show today go ahead and pick up his book. Christmas just ended, but it's a great gift to give. He's a great man, and by all means, I'm sure he can tell a great story. For us personally, I'm thinking that the house shoes you got me made out of beaver are not going to be enough.
So we're going to close with that. So on behalf of our co-host, Michelle Forteau, and our guest today, Joe Henderson, the author of Malamute Man, my name is Robert Forteau. Never forget your dreams. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.